May it please the court, my name is Nathan Nelson and I represent Mark Zwaber. We're here today because the trial court erred at the district court level in two ways. The first was when it did not apply McShane in its factual findings, and second, when it found that the actions of the government entity were not the cause of the decrease in value of Mr. Zwaber's property. First, as it relates to the application of McShane, within the trial, we cited to the cases of McShane, specifically Pratt, and within that, McShane isn't necessarily the law, it's the interpretation of the law, it's the foundational piece. And we start with the Penn analysis, which just says, really at its heart, without getting into all the elements, if you have a complete taking, you have to have a complete loss of value of the property. And McShane allows for a more narrow interpretation where it can be just a diminution of value. Within McShane, it found, DeCook found that a decrease of $170,000 was enough to be a substantial reduction in value to find a taking. Because the Minnesota Constitution is broader than the federal, we typically start at that federal level at the Penn and then move on to McShane. The district court found that the government interfered with Zwaber, found that there was a taking, but found that it was not compensable because the fair market value was not entirely lost. We believe that the error was both in finding that there was not a complete loss and also in finding that the McShane, not applying McShane to find at least a partial loss.
Do we need to find enterprise, joint enterprise to apply McShane?
McShane does state in and of itself there has to be an enterprise for its application. Pratt expanded that and said that, well, there's arbitration, there's enterprise. It's hard to distinguish that. In most cases, they're not clear cut. And Pratt just applied it to any hybrid situation where it wasn't clear. And in Pratt, it was a situation where a private landowner, the statute was applicable only to the, ended up being only to that landowner because he could only be the only one in his land to harvest rice. And they found there that while it was kind of a hybrid because it was an activity which was benefiting the public as a whole, but this impact was only on that landowner.
The Indian treaties overlaying Pratt, right?
We do.
Which we don't have here.
That's correct. We don't have that here.
What do we do with language and DeCook and other cases that talk about municipal airports and McShane maybe being limited to those sorts of situations?
I think that limiting it to just municipal airports is too narrow. McShane said in general, and it was in a line of cases dealing with airports, so it made sense its application to an airport. But at its heart, it said, if there is a decrease in value and the government caused it, there's a taking that's compensable on the part of the landowner. Airport cases are much easier to interpret because it's there, but I don't read anything in DeCook or in those interpretations to say we can only have airport cases. It just says they're applicable to airport cases. And then Pratt comes in, does have the treaty issue, but does say, yeah, we're going to take this and expand it because it's not limited to just airport. This is impacting landowners.
So, counsel, let me ask you, and you're much more schooled in this area of law than I am, but you know, if we're going to say that McShane applies, it seems to me we'd have to identify the government enterprise that was undertaken here. And that's where, you know, we have it in these other cases that we're talking about. We've got the airport, or we've got the Indian treaties. What do we have here as the government enterprise?
Well, I think that the government enterprise ends up being an enterprise where they were concerned about Lawrence's success. And so they were passing regulations that were going to guarantee Lawrence's success, which was going to benefit Scott County.
That doesn't sound like a government enterprise.
Well, I think it's more of a hybrid.
Okay.
Between the arbitration clause and the enterprise standard. Because
they
it's not.
They were very successful, didn't warrant declare bankruptcy?
They did.
Yeah.
And the success of the enterprise isn't the standard, however.
Yeah.
It's just that there was a standard. So here they were, much evidence submitted at the trial court that Laurent was saying, hey, we don't like this, please pass this regulation. And the county said, okay, we'll do that. And they were doing everything they could to put Laurent in a position to succeed at the detriment of Mark Zweber.
So are you actually making the argument that Laurent was the enterprise?
I'm making the argument that Laurent jointly with the governmental entities is the enterprise.
Because just wanting an enterprise to succeed sounds like something that commonly happens, They want Amazon to come up into the northwest suburbs, so they're going to make some accommodations. I don't think that, does that make it an enterprise involving the county?
I think that.
That seems like a stretch from Minnesota law.
I think that if Scott County had modified some regulations for Laurent in their construction to make them successful, that's okay. Which in the Amazon example, yeah, we're going to give you some accommodations so you're successful. Here, they said, we're going to take your competitor and we're going to put hurdles in front of your competitor to make it more difficult for them to be successful against you. And that is at the position where I say the governmental entity doesn't get to do that without it rising to the level of a taking.
Because the government has at that point become part of the Laurent enterprise?
Correct.
Okay.
So the other comment about this point, the McShane test that I noted in the district court's decision is that the district court said that this question of whether the McShane, either it's a test or a prong, should be applied in this case wasn't submitted with your trial brief. Certainly was something that came up, I believe, in the summary judgment process. It came up post-trial, but it wasn't raised in your trial brief. Is that an accurate statement by the judge?
We didn't use the word McShane.
Okay.
That is accurate. Mm-hmm. We did cite to other cases in the McShane line. So the McShane analysis was part of our brief. We just didn't use the word McShane.
So your focus in the trial brief was the earlier argument that you made that this is a partial taking. This isn't a complete taking.
That's correct. And okay. I also mm-hmm. think that we are successful on Penn under a complete taking analysis. But in the absence of that success, the trial court is required to apply McShane because we had pled the Minnesota Constitution within our pleadings and then cited it in our briefs.
Well, and it is remarkable. I mean, certainly to your credit that the district court's findings did go in your favor on elements 2 and 3 of the Penn Central test, but failed on 1, which I think is sufficient to lose, and nobody's saying otherwise. So it's the only issue you're raising on appeal. So again, the judge's remarks on that seem to be that there was not expert testimony in the record that linked the drop in value to this land to the conditions that were imposed by the government. So how do you respond to that?
That's correct. And what I would say is the key piece of evidence the court had to ignore to get to that conclusion was that the Scott County's own property tax records during 2008 and 2009 had an appreciation in property values from 500 to 800-ish. So during this time they're saying that the Great Recession is causing a reduction in value, we're looking at that as an other cause. Your expert isn't saying this is the direct cause. They have an old admission against
interest. Is that evidence sufficient to carry your burden of proof on the first element? Because if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that if we look at all overall property values in Scott County, we'd see an increase during this time period. Is that
specifically, Mr. Zweber's property was increasing in value. So the expert testified that when you look at the Great Recession, you can't look at it and say during a course in time, okay, yes, there was a drop in property values nationwide, but you can't say on this specific day it hit this specific property. So we have to rely on other things, such as Scott County, in its own property tax assessments, looking at the property is actually saying, here's an increase. So when it came time to collect money on taxes, they weren't seeing a great recession and not a hit on property values. They were seeing an increase in property values.
And so, under the Penn Central test, it's your burden to prove element one, correct?
That's correct.
And I have looked at Dr. Hokanson, I don't recall his credentials exactly, that your expert had three different valuations, and then his testimony is there. Where in his valuations or in his testimony can I locate an opinion that the values that he's computing or estimating are causally related to the condition?
He did not testify that they were causally related. He just testified that a value on one day and a value on another day, and there was a decrease.
Okay, so how do we get from the requirement, the burden of proof, to that gap?
Because the only change in the property during that time was the implementation of Scott County's different items on the property, such
that's
as
the
cul-de-sac.
Only thing that changed? So it would always, you're arguing that the district court couldn't have possibly found any other factor.
I think when the district court said the cause was the Great Recession, that was reversible error because they had to ignore the fact that Scott County's property values were increasing on this particular piece of property.
Well, the judges, as I read the opinion, the judge's issue with crediting your expert is that the valuation shows, I'm reading from the opinion now, shows the property's value on the extraordinary assumption that all lots were fully developed and sold in a single transaction. The valuation does not analyze or consider the conditions in any way. In fact, plaintiff's own expert was not aware that the conditions existed. And my understanding is that the conditions that you're complaining about are the phasing and barricade conditions. Those were the two conditions, right?
That's correct.
And so, to Judge Rodenberg's point, where is the evidence support in the record that those two conditions affected the property value?
I think it's an accumulation of the evidence of a decrease in property value during that time, an increase in raw land value based on Scott County's own records. And so an expert saying, yes, this property is now going to sell for less, but this development is worth less. And I think that the key component of that is the expert couldn't point to anything similar and say, yes, in Scott County, here's a barricade they've done, so I can tell you that it's decreased by X amount of dollars. But what we did have evidence of during negotiations that was presented was that they looked at Mr. Zwaber jointly developing this property with the county, and when they submitted evidence of what they thought those valuations would be, they found it to be back at the original value. So that evidence of, yes, we're going to pull all those out, and by our records, lot value, total value is going to be around $5.2 million. Our expert's saying, yeah, but with those on there, it's much less. It's in that 2.8 range. We have a significant reduction in value. And so it's accumulation of the evidence from Scott County on their own. Here's how we're valuing the development. Here's how we're valuing the raw land. And then our expert saying, here's 2 points in time. Here's the change, and here's the value at this point.
Without considering the conditions.
I think it is a misstatement to say conditions aren't considered. I think it's an accurate statement to say the expert couldn't say, because you put in a barricade, I can tell you this is how many dollars it would cause in a decrease in value. And I think that's a nuance that's lost in the trial court order.
But is the trial court wrong that your expert wasn't aware that the conditions existed when your expert gave the valuation opinion?
I believe that the expert did know the conditions because the expert was involved in the property, had been inspecting the property, would have seen the property, would have understood.
Can you point to the record where your expert takes those two conditions into account?
I cannot.
I thought the expert said he didn't know about the conditions until he was deposed. Am I missing that?
I think that the expert understood that there were conditions, but the specifics of the conditions and valuation was not aware and was not part of his analysis.
He says, I had never heard of any conditions at all until the deposition. That's on page 271.
Right, and I read that, and I understand that to mean he didn't understand that a governmental body had put conditions on the property. He just understood that there were these pieces that were now part of the property. So he knew there's a barricade. He didn't know why there's a barricade. You know, or he knows that there needs to be a cul-de-sac, doesn't know why there needs to be a cul-de-sac, because it wasn't relevant for his analysis.
Was he rehabilitated on redirect after that testimony?
I do not believe he was. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will, of course, have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. So, counsel for respondent, when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel, Jason Kubuschek on behalf of Scott County and Credit River Township. This appeal follows a 3-day court trial before Judge Stacy in Scott County District Court. Following the court trial, the parties submitted post-trial briefs. The court then issued an order for judgment and memorandum, and Mr. Zwaber then filed a post-trial motion for new findings and new trial. Judge Stacy denied that. The evidence in this case showed that Mr. Zwaber moved forward with the biggest residential development in Scott County in 2006. This was Mr. Zwaber's first and only residential development. He was not an experienced residential developer or commercial developer for that part. The evidence in the case also showed that it was not the conditions imposed by Scott County at the preliminary plat stage that caused the damages to Mr. Zwaber. Instead, there was evidence and testimony presented at trial that the cause of Mr. Zwaber's issues was the real estate market and the timing of this. So Mr. Zwaber has first challenged it on the McShane analysis, arguing that McShane should have been applied in this case. I think as the court noted in its questions to appellant's counsel, McShane was raised multiple times. We had multiple summary judgment motions on this. McShane was raised, and the most recent, the second round of summary judgment motions, Judge Stacy indicated there was a factual dispute about it. That was an issue that had to be decided at trial. Zwaber never raised it at trial. Zwaber didn't raise it in his post-trial briefs. Now, I heard...
Would you agree with his argument that McShane is really about whether we recognize a partial taking by regulations as opposed to, you know, the typical action that completely takes a property, government action that takes a property?
I would say that McShane, when you compare McShane to Penn Central, they are different in that you have to have that government enterprise. And it then, once you determine there's that joint enterprise or with a government entity, then it gets down to the difference between McShane and Penn Central is how you determine the damages sustained. There's a different measure of damages, whether it's a substantial diminution in value under McShane or it's a reasonably economical use remaining under the Penn Central. Here, you know, we didn't have that McShane argument raised at trial. I think the court noted and in its post-trial motions that nowhere in the transcript is joint or enterprise ever mentioned. You know, they can talk about Laurent objecting to their development, but there is no evidence in the record of a joint enterprise. You know, we also heard that in their post-trial briefs, they raised the McShane, not stating specifically McShane, but the progeny of McShane. When you look at their post-trial brief on page 18 and 19, they don't even get into the McShane analysis. Yeah, they cite to DeCook, but they don't get into any McShane analysis. They don't get into the joint enterprise. And that's what the court said was completely lacking in their motion papers. And the judge did, in the footnote one, page 7 of the March 12th, 2018 order, the court did say that, you know, they should have argued McShane and then took the next step. The very last line says, regardless, because the damages are not attributable to the condition of this case, plaintiff would have been unable to succeed under McShane. So the court did say, you know, you didn't raise it. You've waived that argument. But even if you had, your lack of causation is fatal to your claim.
Setting aside the waiver position, and I appreciate you've made that argument, and the judge has made some comments as well. Here's the part I'm trying to understand the connection between. So the district court, when it did go through the Penn Central test, found investment-backed expectations were affected, and it described the character of the government action as the defendants having targeted plaintiff's property and that the defendants imposed Lorentz demands without examining their legitimacy or purpose, and then goes on to make some additional findings. So I understand your point that they don't brief joint enterprise and the McShane test, but some of these findings by the court seem to me to get awfully close to recognizing a joint enterprise, and I wonder if there's some tension in the district court's findings in that regard.
First of all, obviously the respondents would disagree with how the district court characterized those particular elements of the Penn
Central
test.
You didn't appeal that issue.
We didn't appeal
that. So those are final as far as we're concerned.
Oh, I understand. Yeah. And I think that they don't go far enough for a joint enterprise. When you look at the joint enterprise cases, obviously McShane, DeCook, they are all municipal airport cases where you've got a municipal entity and that there's specific regulations that are benefiting that entity. You've got the Pratt case, which is a unique one in that you've got the Indian treaties in that. And we cited, there's been multiple times it's been raised, we cited 4 cases in our brief where, you know, wetland regulations and drive permits don't raise to the level of a joint enterprise. Comprehensive planning doesn't rise to the level of a joint enterprise. A proposed energy park or rezoning doesn't rise to the level of a joint enterprise. A joint enterprise is a very unique thing. And the fact that Laurent came in and said, we think this is going to hurt our development. It's going to hurt our residents because they're driving construction traffic directly past their homes. And the county looked at it and said, you know, you might be right. We're not going to do exactly what you want. Because what Laurent wanted was no connection at all between the Zwaber property and the territories. The county said, no, we're not going to do that, but we'll put a barricade in place to minimize the construction traffic until, you know, Zwaber's development's 90% complete, and then we're opening the barricade. That's not enough to rise to a joint enterprise. We're not in financial agreement or financial, I'm trying to think of the right word. We're not in the same financial shape. We're trying to make money off the territories, or, you know, it's beneficial to us. It, you know, the county succeeds when all developments succeed. And we're trying to protect our citizens. So I don't think the fact that, you know, Laurent pressured the county looked at it and said, yeah, maybe you're right, we'll do that, and Judge Rex Stacy found that the Penn Central elements were found, doesn't mean that the joint enterprise elements have been found and we can go down the analysis of a McShane type case. I think the big point, if we get past that, like you said, past that waiver of the McShane argument, is the complete lack of causation. Whether or not, even if McShane was in play, or as it is the case with the Penn Central case, the complete lack of evidence of causation. Mr. Holkinson's failure to even consider the conditions when he made these random appraisals. And they truly are random, because the dates he chose are not tied to anything. They're not dates that the project would have moved forward. It's a date there was a county board meeting and another date in the future. They're not tied to anything specific. So they're very speculative as to what exactly they show other than just the value of that property at that particular time.
So if we were to apply the McShane test, would your argument about the deficiencies in the expert's testimony, would it be the same?
They would be the same, yes.
Just so it like still has to be a link, the diminution in value to the conditions.
Absolutely. Okay. Because McShane is a substantial diminution of value. But they didn't show any diminution of value tied to those conditions. And Judge Stacey noted that in that footnote from the initial trial order, that even if they raise McShane, they can't meet it because of the lack of causation. The other item which was briefed was that the Mr. Zwaber is challenging the court's rejection of their equal protection claim. And there, the court found that they are not similarly situated to any other developer. You know, they argued they were treated differently, but they never proved they're similarly situated to anyone. They kept trying to say we're similar to the territories, but when you look at the size of those developments, the phasing that went into the territories, the type of rezoning that went in, these were two very distinct developments. So they're not similarly situated, even though they're adjacent to each other.
That's what I was going to say. They do have some significant characteristics in common. They're located right next to each other, and they're both housing developments in the same period of time.
They're next to each other. They're both housing developments. The approvals were at different times. They're obviously trying to be developed at the same time, but the approvals were at different times. And the phasing of the territory was different than the Zwaber development.
But, I mean, do they have to does their phasing have to be, like, in lockstep in order to be similarly situated?
I don't think
similarly situated means identical.
I would agree it's not identical, but if you look at the case law, they have to be coming in for approvals at roughly the same time. They have to be similar enough that there aren't these huge distinguishing factors such as like the rezoning, the difference in the rezoning for these, the types of developments.
No doubt about the zoning, but they were coming in to the zoning people in the same general period of time, and we know that because the district court found that the county was acting in response to the one development in imposing conditions on the other.
Correct, but the territory's development approval, preliminary plat approval, was at least a year in advance of the Zwaber development. So they were different in that time frame. But I agree that they're both being built out at what would be a similar time frame. And we'd also ask, with respect to the equal protection, that this court uphold Judge Stacey's other finding on that issue, that, again, the causation was lacking. We couldn't prove up the damages tied to the equal protection and what Mr. Zwaber allegedly has sustained. And the final thing, what we did raise in our brief as an appellant was this waiver, whether or not Mr. Zwaber waived his right to challenge these constitutional issues. It had been denied at summary judgment, and again, Judge Stacey addressed it in the post-trial motions. He denied it. We believe that between the testimony at the county board meeting, as well as the developer's agreement, in which Mr. Zwaber had input, because that development agreement incorporated the conditions, and one of the conditions was the barricade that the county wanted up on the mayor's court part of the development. Mr. Zwaber added in the development agreement negotiations, a barricade at the northern part on the Sundance Drive development, that development agreement has a waiver clause, which Mr. Zwaber did agree to waive any claims related to this development against the county. So we would ask that this court reverse the district court with regard to the waiver, find that Mr. Zwaber did waive those issues and challenge. Unless there's any other questions, I don't have anything further.
I just have one small question on that. It looked like neither party got costs and disbursements from the district court. Am I right?
That is correct.
So there's no, if you prevail, I don't know that you will, but if you prevail on the issues that are raised in the principal appeal, do we reach your waiver argument for any reason?
I want to make sure I understand your question.
If you prevail
on waiver.
If you prevail on their appeal, is there any reason to reach waiver?
I think the case can be dismissed if this court upholds Judge Stacey's rulings on the regulatory taking and equal protection. But we also, if the court does reverse Judge Stacey on those issues, then we would definitely like the waiver issue addressed.
Okay, so there's no independent cost and disbursements reason that we should reach that. That was my real question.
That, not that I'm aware of.
There's nothing pending back there that's going to affect.
No.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to address the class of one issue on our equal protection claim. This is a little bit of a different situation of your typical class of one, right? Because in a typical class of one, you might have something where it says, hey, you granted an easement to my neighbor and you didn't grant it to me. I think that's wrong. I think I should be treated fairly. And then we look at the time period. We look at the reasons for the easement. There might be some legitimate reasons. Here, really what we're saying with Mr. Zwaber, he had conditions put on his property. He was required to do certain phasings that no one else ever had been required to do and still hasn't. And that is his class. His class is just developers in general. And I think it's a different, because we're not asking for some very specific, we didn't get what we wanted. It was, hey, Scott County, you're not applying the rules equally. And therefore, the interpretation of the class of one can be a little bit broader than in most of the cases that I've cited, which are very narrow interpretation. And so to go off on that, I correctly identified Laurent is right next door.
Yeah, they're right next door to each other. And it seems like Judge Stacey is finding that they were taking actions to favor one over the other.
Exactly.
That sure sounds like an equal protection claim to me.
And if we use that narrow interpretation, if Laurent and Zwaber don't qualify as parties that are similarly situated, I don't know that you can ever have one that's similarly situated. Is there a size difference? Yes, but the biggest thing is that phasing piece of requiring Zwaber to phase a certain way that no one else is required to do.
You mean that 90% deal, the barricade stays there until it's 90% done?
Well,
or the west to east business.
The west to east, but also the barricade, because Zwaber didn't control all the lots, so to get to 90% wasn't solely in his control. Also required mayors to do some things. So he was given a condition that he couldn't control entirely. And we're expected to believe, well, that didn't, you know, that was addressed equally. Not really. No one else in Scott County has those type of conditions put on them. So we just want, you know, from our position, class of one, we just want developers to be treated and have the rules applied equally to all.
You agree, though, you still have to prove damages, right?
I agree.
And unfortunately, these two developments have one other thing in common.
They do. They both did not survive.
Right.
I think a significant difference there is Lawrence didn't survive. Lawrence was given control to build how they wanted to build, sell how they wanted to sell, and they didn't survive. Mr. Zwaber wanted that same chance. He wasn't given it. So by requiring him to build in a way that was the most expensive, that would front load all the costs, they doomed his development to fail.
There is another way to interpret that evidence, though, too. That is that no matter what, even favored developments didn't work during that period of time.
It can be interpreted. However, Scott County had evidence that 2.5 acre lots were still selling. They were selling at the price point that Zwaber was going to sell at. So by their own records, Mr. Zwaber would have been positioned to survive any type of recession. But by front loading the cost would have required his cost to be so significant that they then would not have sold. They eliminated his ability to act in the free market. I'll just quickly address the waiver issue. Against public policy, clearly he's not waiving his constitutional rights. Cases cited have talked about, usually in the criminal situation, we're allowed to do some waiver of constitutional rights. Normally there's a benefit conferred. They're getting a deal. Here, you have to knowingly be waiving those rights, and here I don't think anyone can argue that Scott County pulled aside Mr. Zwaber and his counsel and said, hey, we're planning to violate your equal protection rights. please sign this waiver so you can go forward.
Well, I think respondents' argument is a little more subtle than that. They're saying that in this MDA, Mr. Zweber agreed to the conditions that he's now challenging are unconstitutional. So by contract, you, of course, can, in fact, waive certain types of challenges.
But only if the bargaining power is equal. As the case says, if you don't really have any bargaining power, you're not really, that's not a negotiated point. Mm-hmm. And evidence of that lack of bargaining power is the fact that the Court of Appeals ordered Scott County to approve a development, and they hadn't. They just refused to, and it required Zweber to go through this process again. He was just trying to advance it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So our thanks to counsel. The matter was well-briefed and well-argued. It's now taken under submission to this court for a decision. We will issue a decision, written decision, within the statutory time frame. So thank you. So we have reached quite a few minutes before our next matter is going to be heard. I'll ask the marshal to check in the hallway and see if perhaps counsel for the third matter in our oral argument calendar are here early. If they're not, we may take a recess. But we'll wait just a few moments. Good morning. We have not called the third matter, but if you'd like to take a seat at council table, you're welcome to do so. We'll see if counsel for the appellant is also available, and maybe we'll start early. We'll see. And we do appreciate you coming.